Women on the Line, produced at 3CR, acknowledges the people of the Kulin Nations, true owners, caretakers, and custodians of the lands from which we broadcast. We pay respect to elders past and present of the Kulin Nation, and we recognise their unceded sovereignty. Welcome back to another episode of Women on the Line, a national feminist current affairs program produced and presented at 3CR Community Radio in Naarm, Melbourne, and broadcast across the continent on the Community Radio Network. I'm your host for today, Shahrazad Bloul. In this episode, we will bring you the histories that are often erased. And here we're talking about Arab-Jewish solidarities, but in particular, the history of Arab-Jewish solidarities and their erasures. And so our guest is Sadia Agsus-Bienstein, who is a researcher, translator and activist, and whose work challenges the colonial story that Arabs and Jews were destined to be enemies. Sadia reminds us that across North Africa and the Middle East, Arab and Jews lived together as neighbours, as comrades, as kin, long before colonial powers worked to divide them. And so colonialism and Zionism fractured these ties, erased the Arab from the Jew and the Jew from the Arab, conscripting Jews as foot soldiers for the Western Empire. Remembering these solidarities against fascism, against anti-Semitic laws in Europe, against colonial rule throughout the region, from the Mashrek to the Maghreb, is also about building possibilities for the future and for the present. So this conversation was recorded at a recent teaching organised by Tasneem Samak and myself and hosted at the Institute of Postcolonial Studies in Naarm, Melbourne. So in the first half of this show, we're going to be hearing Sadia's talk. And in the second half, she joins Tasneem in discussion, reflecting on what these erased histories mean for anti-genocide resistance today, and especially for Gaza and especially for Palestine. But first, let us hear from Dr. Sadia Agsus-Bienstein.
Now, let me talk to you about this experience of Palestinians of 48 in the 50s in Israel. So in a French language article I wrote, I examine a raw moment of cultural and literary exchange between Palestinian and Israeli intellectuals, focusing on the Palestinian poet Rashid Hassin. You know, his poems are available in Arabic online, and you can see some of them were translated. And the Arab Jewish Israeli critic and translator Sasson Somer. Both men shared the Arabic language and culture, and both sought to build a common intellectual and literary project. However, despite their efforts, this attempt ultimately failed. And let me say why it failed. So the 1948-49 war gave birth to the new Palestinian group. This group we call Palestine, you know, Palestine Tamani Arba'in. They remain on their land at the cost of isolation and military repression, making life difficult within a majority Jewish society. This same society, which was held as a model by different organizations, I'm talking especially labor organizations around the world, presenting the Israeli society as like some kind of socialist paradise. And the kibbutz was used to like, look at the kibbutz, everything is shared. But we know that the kibbutz, you needed to be Jew, first of all, to be part of the kibbutz. And it was actually a segregated and a racist institution. The history of Palestine of 48 is part of the destruction of historical, you know, Palestine, leading to the expulsion and exile of more than 800,000 Palestinians. Those who remained formed a small group of just over 150,000 at the end of 1949. Some of these Palestinians were stripped of their historical property rights to the land of former Palestine through their new status as absentee, established by Israeli law. From the outset, these Palestinians were marked by nearly two decades of isolation under a military regime that lasted from 1948 to 1966, confining them to a reduced and fragmented space. This is one part of the Nakba. The Nakba also carried a cultural catastrophe. The destruction of major urban cultural centers, Yaffa, Jerusalem, Haifa, Lid, Akka, and the departure of the expulsion of much of the intellectual elite. The challenge for this Palestinian was crucial to maintain a hegemonious Arabic culture space despite several religious and geographical fragmentation. Poets like and writers like Mahmoud Darwish, Emil Habibi, Hanna Abu Hanna, Rashid Hussein belong to this small fraction of intellectuals who took on politically and culturally the cause of Palestine and Palestinian Israel. However, the Arabic language and culture in Israel were not exclusively a Palestinian experience, but it was also a Jewish experience. To remind you, more than 50% today of Israeli population is Arab. 50% is Arab Jew. They are like, you know, they came from Islamic, you know, Arabic space. And 20% are Palestinian. So the Ashkenazim, yani the European Jews, are a minority, actually. So in the early 1950s, Jews commonly referred to in Israel today as Mizrahim or Arab Jews arrived in Israel. These were Jews from Arab countries rejected or excluded from their ancestral homelands and who found refuge in the young state. I would like also to mention that the Mossad used terror and, you know, bombs in Iraq and other places to push the Jews to leave, you know, their homes and join Israel. So Arab Jews had more cultural and linguistic affinities with Palestinians than with the European Jews, the Ashkenazim, who founded the state of Israel. Yet this shared Arabness was also the cause of their segregation in the 1950s, Israeli society, which was largely led, as I said, by Western political elite. That marginalization was tied mainly to the Arab component of their identity, which they had to partly share to integrate into Israeli society. So when these Jews arrived, they were asked to not speak Arabic and to change their name and to choose not Jewish names, Israeli names, you know. And to remind you what this elite, this political elite that built the Israeli state did to the Arab Jews, they did it to also the Holocaust survivors, right? When they arrived in Israel, they were asked to be quiet and not even to speak Yiddish, you know, because this is the language of the weak Jew who was sent to the death camps, right? It's after, you know, from the beginning of the 60s that Israel will use the Shoah and the Holocaust in order to build its, you know, and to justify all the crimes they will, you know, organize from that period. So we'll come back now to the Arab Jews. So the arrival of these Arab Jews and their difficult integration led some to attempt a dialogue with Palestinians. Sasson Somer, one of the main figures in this history, came from the Iraqi Jewish immigration. Upon his arrival, he saw native Palestinians actually as Israeli. He called them Israeli. As he notes in his autobiography, Life After Baghdad, I'm quoting him here. He said, in fact, the first Israeli I met was none other than the writer Emil Habibi, a Christian Arab. So Habibi was a prominent Palestinian writer and multiple-term member of the Israeli parliament for the Communist Party. Beyond sharing the Arabic language and culture, membership in the Communist Party proved decisive for many of these intellectuals, as it was the only political organization in Israel that included both Jews and Palestinians and claimed to be binational. And actually, the few intermarriages between Jews and Palestinians, they all belonged to Communist Party. So for Palestinians in Israel, bilingualism in Arabic and Hebrew was a strategy for survival. As a minority, they were compelled to use Hebrew to integrate into the dominant society while working to revive their own Arab culture. This is why Ibn Habibi, Samih al-Qasim, Jabra Nicola, Rashid Hussein, and many others mastered Hebrew. For Mizrahim, however, learning Hebrew and modern Hebrew culture was not a constraint, but because they were Jews, you know, right? But rather a test for their acceptance by the host racist society. Arab Jewish intellectuals learn Israeli Hebrew upon arrival, but remain deeply attached to the Arabic language and culture. It was precisely in this space of linguistic and cultural sharing that the first cultural dialogue between Jews and Palestinians in Israel took shape in the mid-50s, influencing each group's effort to rebuild Arab culture in Israel. Arab Jews worked alongside Palestinians in translation, literature, and the press. As Mahmoud Ghanaim notes, this Palestinian and Arab Jewish intellectual dynamic was decisive for rebuilding the culture of the Arab minority in Israel. Most of them were Iraqi Jews, whose political sympathies range from the Communist Party Maki to the United Workers' Party Mapam. They excelled in translation between Arabic and Hebrew, thought not only in Arabic literary writing. From the Palestinian cultural perspective, the early 1950s marked the beginning of a potential link between these groups in a decisive context. This Mizrahi-Palestinian cultural interaction partly filled the absence of a dialogue between Palestinian intellectuals and the Ashkenazi Jews, who had actively participated in the 1948 war and the destruction of historical Palestine. In contrast, Arab Jews, intellectuals, has not taken part in that war. They came in the 50s, right? They don't have any responsibility in the Nakba. So the arrival of Arab Jews, particularly from Iraq in Israel, created a potential space for cultural encounter between Palestinians and Israelis. And I really believe that it could have been, you know, could have been a reality with Arabic language and culture as a possible common ground. Yet in a state privileging Hebrew and Jewish culture, this Arabness placed both groups in the margin. Arab Jewish intellectuals like Somer lacked the authority to make such cooperation truly meaningful. But it's important to note that there have been numerous cases of solidarities between Jews and non-Jews in Arab world, particularly within the communist parties. In Palestine, however, this proved more complicated as the Jewish member of the Communist Party of Palestine were absorbed into the Zionist movement. They called themselves communists, and I think they were really honest when they called themselves communists, and thus claimed, you know, to be working toward an egalitarian society. Yet they defended the project of a Jewish state in Palestine. Even more gravely, you know, they participated in the Judaization of the labor force in mandatory Palestine. At the same time, the Comintern trained a new generation of Arab communist leaders, such as Mahmoud al-Atrash al-Maghribi or Najat al-Sidqi, who played an important role in campaigns to recruit Arab workers into the Communist Party. These were also instances of joint struggles. In his book, The Arabs and the Holocaust, Gilbert Achkar shows how the newspaper Palestine, a key voice opposing the Zionist project in Palestine, agreed to a kind of a truce during, you know, the Second World War in order to denounce Nazism and the persecution of Jews in Europe. In Algeria, French colonialism succeeded in separating native Jews from native Muslims through the Cremieux decrees, which granted French citizenship to Jews. Yet during the Second World War, Maghribi, you know, or North Africans in France, both nationalists and communists joined anti-fascist movement. They took part in the resistance, and some never returned from the camps, but we never talk about that. The Paris Mosque, for example, played a role, an important role in the resistance, in hiding Jewish children, and resistance fighters. One must also remember the many colonial subjects who died in combat during the Second World War. In colonial Algeria, several Jews took part in the struggle for the Algerian independence, for example. So the problem today is that the Zionist narrative has succeeded in propagating the false and absurd idea that Arabs supported Hitler. We're constantly reminded of al-Husseini, but what I seek here to understand are the stories of solidarity that did exist, stories that are only overlooked, but more seriously, deliberately concealed. Right? This solidarity was significant, just as solidarity of various Jewish communities worldwide. In the United States, today, here, or even in Israel, through in a smaller scale, with Gaza, are significant today. For it is in their name, like in the name of the Jews, that Israel kills and starves Palestinians in Gaza and terrorizes those in the West Bank. I will add, with the support of the West and some Arab countries. So it's really important for Jewish communities and to bring this history and stories of common life, common struggles, in order to break, you know, all this narrative built by Zionist discourse during the last decades.
We've just heard from Sadia Aksus-Bienstein, who spoke about how colonial divide and rule fractured Arab-Jewish solidarities and erased the Arab from the Jew to make them foot soldiers for the Zionist colonial project. Across these stolen lands now called Australia, you have been listening to Women on the Line. We highlight a range of gender non-conforming and women voices, and we're broadcast across the continent on the Community Radio Network. Up next, we'll hear Sadia in conversation with Tasneem Samak, recorded live at the Institute of Postcolonial Studies. And together they explore how these histories shape the present struggle against genocide in Gaza and how they might open up futures for solidarity.
In the current moment, there's so much that we're searching for. Given that it is a situation of a renewed catastrophe on the Palestinian people, there's no ceasefire. One of the chants we had was a ceasefire now, and we've sort of converted it. We say ceasefire where? You know, like, where is the ceasefire really? Where is the prospect not only of a ceasefire, but of Palestinian freedom and self-determination? And something that comes to my mind when I hear the knowledge that you're sharing about these solidarities is how, as you said, it's deliberately erased or placed in the margin, but also how even within our movements, there can be like a second layer of erasure, because we speak about the current moment and then sometimes we kind of generalize it throughout the Palestinian history. And that can add to this closing in as well. But from what I'm hearing, and, you know, as you mentioned, the Palestinians did attempt various attempts at a resolution. And it seems that why we're here is because those opportunities were lost, were missed, were, you know, badly addressed. And I think that's something that we need to bring into the present to understand what was happening there, so that then when we do talk about ceasefire, we can actually get somewhere. And so I wanted to ask you about the way, I guess, the Holocaust is evoked in the current moment. Currently, the Gaza genocide, there's a renewed discussion about the memory of the Holocaust. And maybe there is an opportunity to, like, revitalize some of these histories that you're speaking to, and rewrite some of the way that Palestinians and Jews think about these genocides together. And I think comparisons are made all the time, right? I wanted to hear from you how those comparisons can be generative and transformative for the current moment. These are questions that we have to think through, right? But we can't think through them without considering how the Palestinians got to, especially in Gaza, to the circumstances that they're in, being placed so much on the periphery that they were placed within siege, having very little interaction actually with, to them, is the other. And then now we're in this situation where they are subjects of genocide, subjects of such severe dehumanization that man-made starvation is used against them, that American mercenaries are in Gaza. And as you said, and I think that is honest, and those of us who are honest and who've been, part of the Palestinian struggle would say that no one thought it would come to this, right? Like, no, really. So, yeah, I just wanted to hear from you what you thought about that question of solidarities and I guess the relation between Palestinians and Israelis in the current moment.
I can answer the question on the Holocaust and Gaza and the genocide in Gaza. And also you spoke about Nakba and the Holocaust, right? Amos Goldberg and Bashir Bashir published a book, an important book called Nakba and Shoah, where it was like a series of articles by Israelis and Palestinians. And the book was introduced by the late Elias Khoury, who passed away a few months ago, the Lebanese writer. And they all talked about, it's not a question of comparing the Palestinian trauma with the Jewish trauma, no. They tried to create a dialogue between both trauma in culture, in every field, right? A really interesting, book. The book exists, it was translated in Hebrew and then translated into, it was written in Hebrew, translated into English. And I will, I think I will really push people to read it. And when they first presented the book, I mean, far right groups organized a protest at Van Leer Institute in Jerusalem to stop the event, right? But this is something that this Palestinian and this Israeli, I think, and I think Amos Goldberg is known now for writing articles about genocide in Gaza. They started this discussion. But I do think that the problem of the drama maybe of Palestine is that we always see Palestinian through the Jewish perspective or Israeli perspective. And it's a problem, right? So I don't remember. I don't know if it's Mahmoud Darwish or it was Said who said, we are famous because our oppressors are Jews, are Jewish. This is where we're famous. Otherwise, no one would hear about us, right? Because it's concerned, to Darwish, right? And he was right? And it's the same thing for the question of genocide in Gaza. I'll give you an example. You had this movie, Zone of Interest. The pro-Israeli groups made pressure on the cinema and they canceled. And then the first time they canceled, second time they canceled, they said, no, she cannot talk because she needs a historian, a specialist with genocide, if she wants to talk. It's like, I don't have the right. They said, like, I can invite the cleaning lady to talk about the movie. I mean, there is no rule, who can discuss a movie. Any human being can discuss a movie, right? But I wasn't going to talk about the Holocaust, about Gaza, because I don't think that Gaza needs the Holocaust to exist. I do think that we need to leave the dead people of the Shoah alone, right? And keep their memory, right? And talk about Gaza as another genocide, right? It's, you know what I mean? So, and everything is so, even on the genocide question, is seen compared to the Jewish genocide. It's not the same experience, it's different context, it's different people, it's not the same number, it's not the same, But it doesn't mean that Gaza is not a genocide. I mean, I don't invent that. I mean, I can rely on specialists like Amos Goldberg or Omer Bartov, and others who voiced their concerns from the beginning or just a few months after the beginning of the genocide in Gaza. And I think that we should start thinking like that. Now, in terms of solidarities, I do think that today, again, the solidarity between Jews and Arab Muslim or between Palestinian and Israeli should build on different ground, different from what happened before. Tell you about the Israeli society, bad news. I was there a year ago. It wasn't a good news, right? You have people, but it's minority, that will go and march and, but among the people who are marching for the hostages, a lot of them are supporting the government, and the expulsion of the Palestinian. So we need to tell this truth. It's not invention, it's not anti-Semite, it's not, The thing about anti-Semitism, what is dangerous today, is that it's used to more divide Muslim and Jews. it used to nourish his Islamophobia, right? I give you an example in France. In France, we don't talk anymore about far-right fascism. We talk about the new antisemitism. We call it couscous antisemitism, which means Arab antisemitism, right? And it's a way also for, in some ways, for the French state, who for decades ignored or denied its role into the deportation and the killing of the French Jews, you know, to also wash its history. So we put everything on the Muslims, you know? They are the new anti-Semite. It doesn't mean that you don't have anti-Semitism, right? And need to be fought, and it's a question of education, and, you know. But it became a main discourse, you know, that separates again more the Jews and the Muslims. And we should fight against that. And by, you know, and bringing some of these common histories, stories, is important. We should also, you know, the main thing for me, again, it's bringing back Palestine, bringing back Gaza to the center, the agency of the Palestinians, you know, because they were deprived from that.
And that's all we have time for today. You've been listening to Sadia Exus-Bienstein together with Tasneem Samak in conversation recorded at the Postcolonial Studies Institute in Naarm, Melbourne, for a teaching we organised together. What we heard reminds us that genocide in Gaza is not separate from the colonial history. Arab-Jewish solidarities were not only possible, they were real, and they were fractured by empire and erased by the Zionist project. Women on the Line is a National Feminist Current Affairs program, and it's produced in the studios of 3CR Community Radio on Wurundjeri Woiwurrung land. And it's broadcast across the continent thanks to the Community Radio Network and the funding support we receive from the Community Broadcasting Foundation. The theme music that you hear on our show is by Ripley Kavara. You can find all our episodes at 3cr.org.au/womenontheline. or wherever you get your podcasts. We'd love to hear any comments or thoughts you might have about the program, so please send us an email to womenonthelineatgmail.com. Or you can also give us a call at 3CR on 03 9419 8377. You can also find us on Instagram and Twitter. I'm Shahrazad Bloul, and tune in again next week for more Women on the Line content on your community radio station.